And a good morning. Welcome into In Focus, News Radio KMAN. Absolutely nothing going on in the news today. That's why we brought in Dr. Timothy Schaefer on the show. Good morning, Dr. Schaefer.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Obviously, there is quite a bit going on in the news. He is, of course, the associate professor at in the Department of Communications Studies at K-State and also director of the Institute for Civic Discourse and Democracy. Kind of a sobering time for America right now, as we're going through all sorts of turmoil and with the coronavirus, with social injustice going on in the country, and then also a big election coming up here. And we'll get into some of those things coming up. But I want to start first with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the longtime Supreme Court justice who passed away on Friday, and just kind of her legacy, obviously just the second a woman ever appointed to that court, and played a very prominent role in advancing women's rights.
Yeah, I mean, a significant moment, maybe not totally surprising, given her age, as many of the justices are rather old, but also the state of her health. Just recently, the recurrence of some cancer, which clearly she succumbed to. The significance of her on the Supreme Court was noted even yesterday by Chief Justice Roberts, and you noted talking about women's rights, but you know the underlying premise, and I should note this and acknowledge it. I've always been aware of Ruth Bader Ginsburg in large part because we are both alums of Cornell University, and so they have often acknowledged her as one of these really notable alumna. And what's driven her work long before she ever reached kind of the federal judiciary and up to the Supreme Court was her commitment to equality, right? So we often talk about it as women's rights, but you know her disposition and approach was to keep asking and pushing those boundaries of what do we do for those who are at this moment and in this time kind of marginalized through legal processes and the like? And so, yeah, so there's a big loss in that sense. She's classically and has been viewed appropriately as falling, unfortunately, we've adopted this language and these categories for the judiciary, but kind of to the left and very much to the left wing of the Supreme Court. But an important perspective. And as someone who's committed to the ideas of civil discourse and the ability for us to have strong views, but to engage constructively, I think the Supreme Court is one of those really robust examples of that being possible, that the relationship that she had with former Justice Scalia is well noted. That they had an amazing relationship, even though kind of ideologically and the way that they would interpret the Constitution were radically different. They still found ways to be with one another. In fact, they would go to the opera and things together. And so the some of the stories in the last number of days, I think, have also highlighted the human nature of who she is, which I think is an important one, since given the larger state of our politics and kind of the overwhelming kind of partisanship and the polarization that's shaping so much of it, especially at the national level, it's easy to forget that she was in fact a human and not simply this kind of figure that is now and very quickly being someone kind of being moved aside, so to speak, so that position can be both appointed, raised and then appointed by the president. So yeah, so it's been a significant moment in a lot of ways, and it's only, I think, exacerbated some of the underlying issues and concerns that have driven a lot of people to the position they have right now.
Obviously, a big hole there on the Supreme Court, and just talk about what her not being on the court now, how that kind of shifts things a little bit.
Well, I mean, so in a very natural way, at this point in time, we have nine justices on the Supreme Court, and whoever is the executive, the president at that time, has the power and the authority to nominate someone and with consent from the Senate to have them appointed. So within kind of the basic constitutional rights, there's nothing out of the ordinary of a president nominating and then potentially having somebody elevated to the Supreme Court through the process that's kind of aligned through the Senate. What makes it an interesting moment is, right, we're counting down literally the number of days at this point to our next general election on November 3rd. Voting has already started in some states. Here in Kansas, we will start on the 14th, right? So it's just around the corner. And so one of the debates that's currently happening, especially from the Democrats, is to say, this is an election year, and not just an election year, but in fact, we are right on the doorstep. It would only be appropriate to allow, quote, the people to decide who the president is, which then has the power and authority to nominate someone. The interesting, and what's causing a lot of issues, the interesting situation here is that this is, for those who pay attention to these things, a somewhat strange quasi parallel, but not exactly repeat of a number of years ago, as President Obama was in his last year of the presidency, and there was an appointment, a possibility to make an appointment, and he nominated Merrick Garland, and it never proceeded. It never went to the Senate, in large part because it was said by then Senate Leader McConnell, who was still in that role then, that it was an election year and we shouldn't do that. For all the same reasons that they are now, the Republicans are saying that that's okay. And so understandably, there are a couple things. One is that the windows of time are really quite different. One was very early in the last year of a presidency, and the other one is at the very end. But the alternative to that potential interpretation is that the Constitution just says the president has the ability to nominate. So in a purely legal sense, what is potentially happening, President Trump said he would anticipate mentioning and kind of publicly presenting his person that he would like to nominate on Saturday, so 2 days from now, is totally legal. The issue for some is that this, again, both speaks of potential hypocrisy, but also of kind of the breaking of certain norms. And we have a really long history, so it's not just these two moments. There have been nominations in the past. We've had a number of these that have occurred largely when the executive and the Senate are of the same party, not exclusively. And then the opposite is also true. So it's not a super clean argument either way, but it does, I think, amplify the real challenge that we confront right now, especially at that federal level, of how do we interact and engage with one another in a more constructive way that at this moment is only seen as potentially fracturing more rather than coming together.
Well, it is very interesting because, you know, he's nominated two Supreme Court justices. I'm talking about President Trump, with Kavanaugh and Gorsuch. And the Gorsuch one was the one that came after the Obama presidency, right, immediately after, yes. I believe.
Yep. Yeah, that's correct. Right. So that was and so it's, you know, for a Supreme Court that's comprised of 9 people right now, it would be significant for a single president. It's sometimes unique to get one nomination, more unlikely to get two, and almost unprecedented to have more than that, so 3 potentially here. And that's significant, especially with not just an election year, but with a current president who is and has consistently been lower in the polls, right, has come to office as just the 4th president to not win the popular vote, right? So his entire presidency has been somewhat shaped by this reality of an elevation to office with obviously the win of the Electoral College, but not necessarily the popular vote. So not necessarily a wide kind of consensus or body of support beyond more of kind of a core group of supporters. And so these are some of the issues that exacerbate, I think, the truly the dilemma that we face right now. And it's a significant thing as we think about what the further kind of repercussions are from potentially taking an action right now, is that what does this do? What does it mean to the composition of the court in the future if the general election actually changes those who are in power, whether it's in the presidency or in Congress, the House and or Senate? Because the number of Supreme Court justices that we have is not set. It's in fact changed, and a number of countries have considerably larger federal or kind of Supreme Courts, like literally dozens, if not into the hundreds, depending on the country that you're talking about, Western democracies. So the model that we have of nine is not, one, it's not set in stone, but two, it's also highlighting, especially given the challenges that we're existing in now and seemingly are for the future, the near future at least, is that the ability for someone to stay alive, for example, if the dying wish that has been reported from Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that she would hope that the next president, whoever wins, whether that's Donald Trump or Joe Biden, make the appointment, that a democracy would not rest upon someone's health in that situation. And I think it only amplifies the issues that we already know kind of underneath it.
Dr. Shaver, we have a caller here with a question or a comment here.
Yep.
Take that here. Good morning. You're on In Focus.
A wonderful explanation of the history that we're living now, and especially telling us the stories that we don't hear from our side of the fence. Can you explain to everybody, so they're not going to be surprised, what's going to happen with the Electoral College when the state legislatures appoint their members, that they know how they're going to vote in order for the Electoral College to repeat what they have done in the past? Thank you.
Yeah, you want to take a stab at that one, Dr. Shaver?
Yeah, so if I could hear that correctly, the question was really about, it sounded like more around the Electoral College process, right?
Yeah, so, that's right.
So we have a fairly unique system, right? Most countries just have a straight up and down vote, and we look at the kind of raw numbers, and we say whoever got first past the poll, right? If there's, you know, two or more candidates, so whoever gets over that 50% is the winner. We don't do that, and we've had a handful of examples, not very many, but potentially a lot of studies have pointed to the very real possibility that we're going to have more kind of these imbalanced elections just because of population density in a handful of places, in contrast to other states, given the way that we have people appointed both through the House and through the Senate. And so the Electoral College, right, is built around this model. So it's a winner take all at the state level, and then that goes up to the winner who gets 270 or more out of the total number of voters of the Electoral College. There has been question, though, and there was actually, in fact, this summer, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that states have the power to require presidential electors to vote for their party's candidate for president. So what's important to remember in general elections for the president is that we don't directly elect a president. We elect electors who then go after the election and formally, and this happens in December, who formally then kind of cast the vote on behalf of their state. And so in July, the Supreme Court, before they had the recess, unanimously ruled that the states have the power to enforce those electors to follow the votes, because there's this language of these of kind of quote faithless actor electors, these faithless actors who might go against. And we, in fact, last election saw two go away from President Trump, and then five, I believe, went away from Hillary Clinton to kind of go to the opposite candidate. And so it's happened some in the past, but the part of what kind of prompted this was a number of states have moved towards something called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, a mouthful, but this idea that if states could leverage their Electoral College power to give their votes to the person who actually won the popular vote across the country, that would in fact not eliminate the Electoral College, but it would give it the ability to feel a little bit unconstrained from that limitation. But all of this is to say the electoral college is a huge factor, which is what determines why presidents go to some states and they don't go to others. I grew up in Ohio, and it was always a swing state for my life. And my wife in New York, and she never experienced, for the time that we lived in Ohio, she had never experienced kind of the existence in a swing state. And for those who have only lived in Kansas, have probably also never had that kind of focused attention that comes from a handful of places because of the strategic nature of the Electoral College and figuring out how do you get to that number that would allow you to win, that 270. And so that's, you know, part of what makes this frankly more complicated situation, this election, but all of our elections in the foreseeable future, is that the fact that we don't simply go by how many people across the United States who are able to vote support a candidate, that doesn't necessarily mean they win, which can, as we're seeing now, exacerbate some of the differences between those who are in support of someone in office and those who aren't.
I'm going to take a break here real quick, Dr. Schaefer, and we got a caller who's going to wait through the break, and we'll come back more in focus after this on KMAN.